In this podcast, we travel back 20 years to the Historical Society program that took place in November 1988. On that evening, 85-year-old Frank Mark was interviewed by Roy Hellander. Frank was born in Finland and immigrated to the United States in 1916. Frank tells a number of amusing and fascinating stories about his life after arriving here in Maynard. Stories of friends, bosses, baking, the famous Democrat bread, and Maynard cornetist Wayne Okapi are just some of the highlights. The original tape has a gap where they played a recording with a performance by Wayne Okapi. We included a portion of what we believe is the recording they played during the meeting. After the music, Roy reads a number of letters from his uncle, Ed Hellander, who came from the same town in Finland as Frank. Ed, then 95 years old, was unable to attend the meeting. We hope you will enjoy this taste of what life was like in Maynard in the first half of the 20th century.
Being here because he's 95 years old and made it very clear that if it was a bad night in any way, he could not come out. But he has provided me with material galore. I also spoke to Frank this summer and told him to think about this sort of stuff. And I guess he's been thinking about it because he's here, right?
Why don't you come up, Frank?
Come on up, Frank. I'll let you sit near the machinery there.
Mm-hmm.
We also
stand up.
No, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
I can stand up.
The Historical Society is in possession of a tape that was made by a very famous Maynard cornetist, Wayne Okapi, back in the 20s, and we're going to lead into that eventually, because Frank is related to him by marriage, and knew him, and we're going to reminisce about him eventually, too. But I think we'll just start. So, Frank,
make you might as well make comfortable, huh?
That's right.
Even that seems so
funny. Well, I don't think it's going to hurt it in any way.
No.
Okay. But how old are you, Frank?
I'm 85 years old. 85.
85. And
yeah.
What year did you come to
1916.
1916. So yeah. Figure that out. How old were you when you arrived?
Well,
not very old, right?
I was 13 years old.
Yeah, a real teenager, right?
Yeah, I was teenager.
Did you come from a large family?
Yeah, a large family.
Where?
I had 9 sisters. So all the girls.
They're all
no
girls
brothers.
Except you. Are you the oldest?
I'm the oldest one.
You were born in Finland?
I was born in Finland. The rest of them were born here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that means that as the oldest teenager, you came here and what did you do for a job?
I went to work in a United Co-op bakery as sweeping the floors and scraping the pans.
And so that kind of got you into the bakery business,
That's
right?
Got me in the bakery business.
So,
I got my fingers in the dough.
He knew where to put his fingers, yeah. Okay. Into the co-op. You never tried to get in the mill or anything?
Yes, I did. I went as an alley boy. I want to get to the mill, get a job, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked Morgan, was a boss them days in the guard room, and I asked him for alley boy job, you know. They need alley boys, you know. They used to put the wool in the machine. So he said, I haven't got anything now, he said, but probably later. And after a week or so, he called me and said, I got an opening for you that you can get a job. But I had a job already in a co-op, see? So so I went to bakery instead of mill. That's how.
And so he's contributed to keeping us all overweight for all these years, right?
The first job I had, really, was down the Davis's farm, you know, going towards Sad Creek, across the railroad tracks up there, the farm, you know, the sharp curve.
Mm-hmm.
Before the, we worked there, and one day, a whole bunch of us, and we got fired. Yeah, because we didn't do enough work, you know. They kick us out. There was a whole bunch of us, you know, picking beans and doing. And I always remember when the when the man, head man, he asked me, asked us if anybody knew how to drive the horse. I did drive the horse when I was a kid in Finland, but I took that horse and buggy, you know, a lot of these bean bushel boxes in there and everything else, and I tried to stop the horse, and I done the same thing, but I done in Finland say, and the horse got so wild, it ran all over the field. Yeah, because you're supposed to say, hold. That's what happened. It went all over the field, and some of the boxes fell out, and that's why I guess the man kind of mad and fired us all, you know. But I had a good idea that, you know, you're supposed to stop the horse same way in Finland, you know, you say, but in here you say, ho, you know. That's what I pointed at.
That's the way it goes with languages, you know, that a rooster never cock-a-doodles the same way in any different language. Every language has their own expression for it. Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Very good. So what was the bakery like that you got into the co-op bakery? Where was it in the first place?
Yeah, it was down Powdermill Road.
Powdermill Road.
Powdermill Road, right next to the gas station, where the gas station is now, almost in the corner there.
Oh.
Yeah. There was a dairy and a bakery and a horse barn there. We had two horses there. Yeah.
Did those horses speak Finnish or anything?
I don't think so. I don't think they were two horses, and then later on they had delivery trucks with those hard wheels. No air tires. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That must have given the cakes a good ride around
Oh yes, them days, yeah. And they used to have two trucks on, one bakery truck delivering stuff to the houses, you know.
I remember that even in my childhood days, I guess most of you do. Oh, yeah. The bakery truck used to come around every day, every week on a certain
day. But
that
was a horse.
But this was a horse.
This was a horse, not a bakery truck.
Can I get another one?
How about...
The history of Finland is they carried it
on. Oh yeah, that's it. That's where it's
I was on Main Street and I was about 8 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. And the sudden thunderstorm came up and Pico Ogiletto had the bakery wagon with a horse in front of the store. He was bringing these big trays of all the donuts and cupcakes and everything else in the store.
Yeah.
Well, I was right in front of John Zaneski, had just built that building.
Yeah.
And I ducked into the doorway, and this big shower came. Well, there was that clap of thunder and the lightning right at the same time. Yeah. And that horse took off. And those donuts and cupcakes and bread and everything else was scattered all over Main Street where that horse just went like one side to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And they went down to it as far as the, what was then Bobness's Market, was down at the corner of, we called it afterwards the Hotel Pleasant, but Harold Butterworth ran out and he grabbed that horse's rein that was loose, dragging in the street, along with the weight that was supposed to hold him.
Yeah.
And he stopped the horse.
Oh yeah, that's true.
So I guess there was a lot more to driving the horse than just being able to tell them to stop and go, right? Yeah. So how did you get into baking then? You eventually stopped cleaning pans, I take it?
Yeah, well, scraping the pans for quite a while. I was getting $12 a week, you know, 6 days a week. Long hours were long. They were sometimes 12 hours a day, 10 days, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
About the same now, isn't it, Al?
Yeah. Yeah, $1 a day, you know, a day.
Okay. Did you have any funny things happening in your baking?
Well, this things cause the ovens were. We had two ovens down there, and they put the coal inside the oven. You know, one corner, and they covered it with the paint. And the bottom feet was very hot, so almost always everything burned from the bar. Yeah, that was true. Yeah, the only way they tested the oven, they took a handful of salt and threw it in there to cool it off, you know, cool the bricks, you know.
Oh.
Yeah, you never heard that before. That's
no,
right. Now you hear the secret. Now what else? Yeah, well, because the bakers, you know, them days the bakers were a little bit on, they hit the bottle quite a bit and so on. But I never did. I get away from the bottles.
That was a failing of the profession that most of them liked to...
But that's most all of them.
Well, that ought to have made for some interesting pastries in our way.
Yeah, they...
Wrong cake.
Not in the cake, anyway.
We had boards, you know, piled out like that, and then Democrat put on there about a dozen Democrats, long boards and long peel handle on a, like a shovel, you know, you shovel it in the oven, you know, and take the bread out with a peel, they call it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was like a shovel, long handle.
Well, now you mentioned Democrats. Tell us about what is a Democrat? I mean,
Democrat history is around 1905, probably, or 6, around there. Manny Rihuama had a baker shop in May Street someplace. I don't know just where it was. But, and there was a fellow named Osmo worked there. And Finns began to want the Democrat, the bread that they had in Finland, you know.
Sour rye
bread, you know, with a lot of rye in it. So the first bread they made, it was awful sour. And they had a lot of rye meal and it didn't have much push, you know. It was kind of flat. But it was awful sour, but people's stomach couldn't take it because the people in Finland, they were working outside in the forest and on the fields. So the stomach dissolved that bread. But in here, they went to work in a factory and they didn't move so much, so they get little cramps in their stomachs, I guess, you know. Because it, so little by little, they cut the sour and rye meal and then came, you know, more of a different kind of bread.
As we know it
now.
And so where did it get its name?
During that time when they made the first demos, Democrats were in power, you know, in the White House. And it was Depression time. Depression, you know. And they wondered what we're going to name this, you know, this bread. So they said, let's name it Democrats. So that's how the Democrat got his name. Depression time and there were Democrats in power. So that was
Wilson.
1905, 1906, around there, you know.
Finnish town had a bakery, and they all had a kind of a bread they made that was special to them. I know Fitchburg used to make something that was different. They'd make like a flatter bread of this kind.
Yeah.
So it depended on where the baker came from, I suppose.
And they made the hardtack, hardtack too, you know, the very thin bread, you know, and they dry it up and eat it. So.
Mm-hmm.
They claim that all this Finnish Democrat bread from Finland, you know, they used to hang them on a ceiling through that hole into the rods. And then when they got so dry, they began to drop down, you know, break down. Then they took them down and put them in the barrels. Mm-hmm. To, you know, they bake on the farms that time, when I was a kid, around two or three times a year. See, they didn't bake every month. So that bread was awful dry. Some old people, you know, soak them in a soup and stuff like that, mm-hmm. to eat it, you know, because but some, once with a good teeth, they went right out like a dog.
I remember when I was a kid, they used to send hardtack from Sweden and Finland, and to come in packages, and occasionally in the summertime it got buggy, as it would, because it had a flour on it, and he'd sit there and he'd break off a piece and he'd whack it on the table until all the bugs fell out, push them away and put the butter on it. So a couple of this past summer, we went to FinFest down in Delaware, and they had a bakery from Florida that had come up, and they had brought a lot of bread with them. Yeah. And they had a very thin sour rye, too. And of course, at the time we were in Delaware, no matter what time you were anywhere, last summer it was terribly hot. And we were on a two weeks vacation, so by the time we got home, this bread was buggy. And I said to my wife, "This is the way we do it."
How about the mold? Did it get moldy?
No, not moldy.
Didn't get moldy.
No, just buggy.
My wife won't let me tell her about the Norwegian caraway. No, what could play this bread?
You tell us about that after we get through, and we ask her some questions. How's about that? When I was talking to my Uncle Ed, and Frank come from the same hometown, by the way. The same area of the town.
Yeah, I knew him in Finland because he came earlier than I did, you know.
He's 10 years older.
I was a young little kid. And I remember a day before when they started to come across, which 1912, the Titanic went down, you know, on April, and that year or two afterwards when they came, the Saku, they call him Saku, he used to play Gardein, you know.
Of course.
And, they were feeling good, you know, up one farm there and that. And he was playing the song, "Near to my God to thee," you know. Luoksesi Jumala kulkee tie, you know. So he was playing that, you know, that now we go into America and that might happen, you know, because the Titanic went down, you know, 1912.
Well, that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. and I remember your Eddie, when he was driving around with a bicycle that had rope wheels, no air tires, but you know,
this
it's
is
so
in Finland?
Poor.
Yeah.
I always mentioned to him, you know, I see him, you remember those ropes on your bicycle wheels?
Well, they both came from big families. I guess that was the style in those days, out in the farm country. When I went down to see him, I mentioned a few names and things to him, and maybe some of you people that grew up in the Finn colony here in Maine can remember some more. But you were mentioning the dairy, he was telling me that there were two co-ops in Maine at the same time, the National Co-op and then what turned out to be United Co-op eventually. And they both had milk departments, and Krekula was the milkman for the National Co-op, and this Oscar... Oscar Lindquist was the milkman for the other co-op.
Yeah.
And they used to deliver milk 3 o'clock in the morning. And one would be up in Assabet Park with his wagon. The other one would be up here on Maynard Hill with his wagon. And about 3 in the morning when it was very still, there was no noise. In those days, they'd converse back and forth. he was also saying that Oscar had a great big voice. And they used to go out to... fishing out in Beverly off the bridge there to catch shiners or whatever they were having. But they used
smells.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But he says they used to talk so loud out there during the night that the people that lived in the area had them banned. So the Maynard Finns were banned from fishing in Beverly for a while. Then I always remember a story that they used to tell. My uncle was telling me that you people have heard about Vakkuri Papugaya, Vakkuri's parrot. Does that sound familiar to anybody? No. Well, I guess there was a guy in Maine, his name was Kalle Vakkuri.
Yeah.
And he was sort of a salesman. He used to listen to a different drummer. He wasn't a factory worker. I guess he made his money doing little business deals and so forth. And one of the things he was going around peddling from house to house at one time was a parrot. And the lady is supposed to ask him, well, does this parrot talk? And he had thought about it for a while. He says, no, he doesn't talk too much, but he thinks a lot. And so whenever there's anybody that's very quiet and doesn't seem to be conversing, as they always say in Maine, that he's as quiet as Vakkuri's parrot.
I remember one funny story I want to tell this.
Surely.
When I was a young town, Roosevelt Street there, we had some rumors, you know, single men, you know, they used to be 2-3 men in one room them days, you know. Yeah. And we had one fella, and he used to get drunk all the time, drink during the time when he's... He didn't work, you know, when he was off work, you know. That was their pastime, you know. And then when he got drunk, he used to go holler like anything out in the street. Mm-hmm. And they never pinched him, you know. The cops, you know, the policemen never pinched him because they knew him, you know. Yeah. And then Sam King, you know, was a chief of police in Maine. You know, he had a stable of horses up there where the fine art theater is today, you know. And I remember Sam, a small fella, you know. And he was kind of deaf that he didn't hear very well. So he went and hollered on his ear, you know.
Oh, this Finn guy.
Chief Finn guy, you know. But he didn't rest him on anything, you know. Then came Charlie, the French policeman, you know. Some of you probably remember older people, Charlie. And he filled that cooler all full of trunks, you know. And he went down the street and hollered, and he got nailed right off.
Uh-huh.
And put on the cooler. And then the pins began to say, ah, you got... He used to brag that he's got the license to haul, are you? And now the Finn said, now you lost your license. Because he pins him, you know. And that's a true story. That's not a fairy tale, you know. No. I don't want to mention the name, but
no,
some of the relatives.
Well,
live around yet, you know.
Looking around quickly, I don't see any relatives.
Yeah,
but we decided that we would not mention names on anything that might embarrass anyone. Because,
yeah, that's right.
What was the name of the fellow that we were talking about one day? I can't remember his name. That was kind of a nature boy, you know. He.
Oh yeah, Lahdenberger. Yeah, he used to work on bare feet. You know, he was a nature boy, really.
Yeah.
You
this
know.
Guy was a real nature boy from way back. He was a very intelligent fellow. My uncle was telling me that when they'd have a meeting or something of the society, he would get up and he could lecture you on any subject because he was so well read.
Yeah,
he was living, I guess, out in Gleasondale at one time. And he walked back and forth always with his bare feet. He always believed in bare feet and not much clothing either. And but he didn't want to disobey the law, so he had stopped Sam King one night on the way home and asked Sam, is it permissible for me to walk in my bare feet, even though I'm going all the way to Gleasondale? And Sam King said, hey, you can do anything you want. He said, that's not breaking the law. He said, well, I just wanted to clarify that I'm not breaking the law. Another guy that listened to a different drummer.
Yeah, he was, I remember him. And he had whiskers.
Yeah, I remember him in the old days. He used to, at that time, live in Boston, and you could find him sleeping on the common, like some of these street people by then. But it was through preference, not through anything that had happened to him particularly, I guess.
Yeah, they claimed that in Boston, you know, when they had the speakers there, well, He argued with him, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in those days there was always a lecturer on Boston Common, remember, and I guess he took care of his own ends. Well, maybe we should get to time as we're moving along, get to Wino and think about him.
No.
Now, Wino Kaupi is from an old Maynard family. Let's see, his mother and father were here already, right?
Yes, they were here, yeah.
And there were what, three boys?
There was three boys. And,
just to get it into your head, Oscar Kaupi,
yeah,
Reno, and then Wino, and yeah, then there were three girls, Franks.
Yeah, two girls.
One, two, three? Bentler and Munding?
Oh, three girls.
Three
that's
girls.
Right. You're right. Bentler and Lempia.
Mrs. Manning, and you know Laurie Manning? Laurie's mother was one of the sisters. And Peggy Wasick. Who is now Peggy Steve Wasick's wife. She was, her first husband died, then she married Steve. And then Frank's wife, late wife, were the brothers and sisters of this family. Some of the Kaupis lived off of Parker Street on, what's the name of that? Parker Place, I guess it is.
Yeah.
And
they lived on top of the store there, too, you know, in that apartment.
Where the corner
store is. Mm-hmm. Ivy's Corner, you know, what they call it.
Well, anyway, this young fellow turned him to be one of these very, very brilliant musicians that comes along only once every so often. I guess he got his start in the local Finnish bands. And by the time you got here, he was already...
Oh, yeah, he was playing with the Coleman band, you know, by that time, Coleman band, and then New York Follies, you know, the later on, and then McAnally's.
McAnally's Orchestra.
Yeah, orchestra, yeah, and then he had his own orchestra, that's the problem.
Some of the newspaper clippings that Ralph gave me showed that he was one of the first cornet players in America to broadcast in the 20s from New York, where they would broadcast concerts from these various rooms. And anything else you can tell us about him?
Well, there ain't much I can tell, you know, only that he went to, what I heard about him, you know, that he went to take lessons, you know, from in Boston, and Paula said, I can't give you no lessons. You're better than I am. See, that's what that the story was. So he never took lessons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, he never took lessons.
Yeah. Yeah, all right. And then so he went on, and what happened to him eventually?
Well, he...
He went the way of all flesh in New York, right?
Yeah. And possibly a life, a past life, you know, with those traveling with those orchestras, you know. It's a fast life, you know.
It doesn't have to be a rock band to have that kind of a life, I guess.
Yeah.
Musicians have been famous for that sort of thing.
Yeah, they travel from place to place, you know, and they're always on a go.
Mm-hmm.
Really, be honest with you, I didn't meet him only about four times, because only when he came around this district, New England, these places around here, you know, like... during the McAnally's times more, you know, but when he played with the Coleman's band, he was soloist, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I guess his biggest time was in Connecticut when they had an outdoor concert, you know, the Coleman's band.
Mm-hmm.
The way I wasn't there, but the way I heard, there was thousands of people and he played that solo there, you know. And that, I guess that was probably his highest in his lifetime.
And so when he died, he was only, what, 30?
34, probably.
Probably 34. So it was a fast life, and it ended early, unfortunately. He got into some trouble and had his teeth...
he was... he came from plane, and he got hit by a car, and he lost his front teeth.
Which is...
And he never get the high tone anymore, you know.
His embouchure is gone, you know, mouth.
That's what happened, you know.
And you were telling me that you were going down to his funeral. Tell me about that that trip. We don't want to get into the funeral itself, but just about going down there. I thought this was pretty good.
It was awful, awful, during the Thanksgiving time, but it was awful cold, cold weather, you know, the freezing weather. And the Hawk Saarinen had a Dodge car and didn't have no heater, no heater, you know, and all. Very many had a Ford Roadster, you know, one of these 32 models, you know, A model, you know, Ford. And when we started from the house, they had bricks in the oven, you know, in the Glenwood oven, you know, in the store. And they heat up the bricks and they wrap them in a cloth, and that was the heater. While it lasted, but it was really cold because that car didn't have no heater, you know, them days. So we went to New York and we stayed there about 4 days. You stay in a field row and so forth.
Well, I thought that was interesting. They already had it.
Yeah.
Heat your feet with warm bricks.
Yeah,
bricks.
And then when we stopped in Hartford, in Connecticut, they had this Yale and Harvard football game that Saturday, and there was a lot of these college boys, you know, celebrating, you know, their victory or their loss, I don't know which, but anyway, they were celebrating, you know. We were in one restaurant, we stopped down there, we had something to drink, you know, something hot, you know. not alcohol, but coffee.
Okay, well, why don't we get to his tape?
Yeah.
You show us how to put it on.
Yeah.
This is a tape that's been given to the Historical Society. Did you bring some pictures of him, too?
I got some in the back.
While the music is playing, we're not going to play all of it, but a little bit.
Cool. Thank you.
So many other thousands. The crossing was very stormy and the passengers were seasick, and that's not an insignificant sickness when you suffer from it for days on end. And when Boston Shore hove into view, the sickness disappeared as if by magic. He said, we arrived in Boston Harbor in the evening, so we had to spend the night at anchor out in the harbor. But the next morning we were allowed on shore and we were examined for the umpteenth time, this time the last time, by a doctor. They were very, very fussy about immigrants not bringing in any communicable diseases, and especially they always looked at your eyes. And if you had some sort of a disease in your eyes, you and your luggage were locked up in a steel cage, not unlike the lion at the zoo. Because I don't really know what happened to them after that. Maybe they looked for a relative here in the United States, or maybe they just sent them back to the old country on the next boat. But there was a young girl with us who was put into this lion's cage, and we were all pretty despondent about it. In Boston, we were met by two men from Maynard who were to take care of any immigrants destined for this town who were arriving on that day. The law then said that you had to have $25 American money on arrival. And this was given to you in exchange for the money that you had paid the shipping company in Finland in the office after you passed the physical. This was to ensure that you had something to live on until you got a job. Well, they herded us up to Boston's North Station. There were eight of us bound for Maynard. And our guides made it pretty clear to us, even though we couldn't speak English, that we were to sit on this long, sturdy bench that had been beautified by years of usage. And we sat there like blackbirds on telephone wires. And our guides then repaired to the adjacent bar room for a couple of beers, and they urged us to keep our eyes on our luggage, which we did anyway. I was seated at the end of the bench, and a bearded gentleman approached and attached a tag to my coat lapel, talking a blue streak all the time and motioning wildly. I didn't understand a word of what he was saying, but from his waving arms, I finally came to understand that it was a question of which train was going to Maynard. We, of course, weren't worried about this because we had the two guys there in the bar room. However, when they put up the number of the train on the board, and I realized it was the same that was on my tag, we all hurried in there to get these two guys out. And so we finally departed for Maine. We got off in West Concord, got on a streetcar, which brought us down to Paper Mill Corner, and here our guides led us across the street to a bar room. And they said, the boys have to have a beer to celebrate their arrival. As I had to use every little bit of English that I had learned on the crossing to convince the barkeep that I was too young to be guzzling beer legally. And that was the first and last time that I've ever been in a bar room in America. I'm really very happy to have been able to follow the making of Maynard history. It's been very interesting. On my own part, I've tried to be active in the making of this history on the part of the Finns. And I congratulate the Maynard Historical Society, for I have many good friends there at Ellendon. Then he also gave me an article about his first job. It says here, a youngster amid new surroundings. This is a teenager now. My first job in America was in the carding department of the American Woolen Mills. In the area that I worked in, all the employees were Finns, including the boss. Of course, the higher echelon of bosses were not Finns. And our big boss was James Morgan, same guy that Frank had mentioned. And a fine boss he was, too. This was a very quiet period for the company, and a representative had gone to New York to try to get new orders. And so we were kept on in case these new orders came, in spite of the fact that we had little to do. Sounds like digital nowadays. Along one side of our workroom, there was a corridor along which these bosses, little ones and bigger ones, moved. And so we were told that at least one man had to be visible at all times, sweeping a few scraps of wool that we kept throwing on the floor. The rest of the men were playing pitch penny in a sort of a castle that we built out of bags of wool, one on top of another in a big circle, and the entrance to which was gained by removing one of the lower bags, which was kind of packed in there loosely. And there was, inside here, there was a fitting knot in the wooden plank on the flooring, and if you could throw your penny closest to it, you won. Of course, the men inside this castle were supposed to be very quiet, but sometimes when the pennies of the two throwers were about equidistant from the knot, a sort of discussion would ensue, and the voices grew louder in the dispute. And it happened then, naturally, that one day when I was on sweeping duty, the dispute in the hideout grew especially loud, and I couldn't resist going in to see what was up. And I tarried for a moment, unluckily, to see how the argument was going to come out. Now, our finished supervisor was Laurie Jokinen. Remember Stammer's jewelry store? Their daughter was Frank Stammer's wife, and they had a son, Polly, and then they had a son, Bruce. He was my supervisor, and he had gone up to the third floor in the freight elevator to write his column about Maiden News for the Finnish newspaper Raivaaja, whose correspondent he was. So I'm not the only guy that writes on company time. There was an empty office up on the third floor. It was a very peaceful place to write. And we had been instructed, in case Mr. Morgan came looking for Laurie, to bang the side of the elevator shaft with the steel cable, and he'd come right down. Well, it so happened this day that since I was inside the castle, Morgan couldn't find anyone to ask for Laurie. Rather, he stood listening and he heard the commotion behind this wall of wool. And pretty soon he removed the bag from the top and then another one and stuck his head in and asked for Laurie. And then he stood there staring at us with his mouth wide open. And I ran out, hurried to the elevator shaft, banged on it. Laurie came down, reported to Morgan's office with no idea of what had happened. Morgan had told them that all the workers that he had were just like a bunch of schoolboys, except that they were gambling with money, while schoolboys would probably be playing with balls. But that was the end of the incident. No one was punished, and that's why I think James Morgan was a fine boss. And then finally he had one that he handed me just before I left, so I haven't really translated this, like this is going to be a little slower. My good friends, you who drive every day in your automobile, you can't imagine what cars were like when they were presented into the moving world. I could tell you something about cars during the World War and a little thereafter, for my brother John had one of those famous Model A tin lizzies. To get it going, you had to crank it from the front, and before you could do that, you had to get in and arrange all sorts of little handles inside so that it would mechanically catch the spy. And if you had to travel during the rainstorm or a snowstorm, you had to trust in good luck, because there was no such thing as a windshield wiper. There was nothing to melt the ice and the snow. There wasn't any heaters, as we found out from Frank. And usually, in this cold time, you had to empty your bed of all the blankets to wrap around your feet, because the floor was cold and drafty, and you had to get dressed as warmly as you could. In fact, you probably looked like you were going to the North Pole. The walls and the roof were of no help in preserving heat, for they were made of thin cloth that was there only to prevent the rain from coming in. And in the summertime, that was taken down, and as you drove along the sandy roads, you could listen to the sand and the stones flying by your ears. And then those tires, which were of terrible fashion, so that you had a flat or two at least on every trip, and you had to patch them up on the way. And there was a great big tool chest on the running board, which had all sorts of tools. And so you very soon became a mechanic, because you would never have reached the end of your journey if you didn't. Then he talks about various parts of the car, which I can't translate because I don't know anything about how a car runs. If your car was in good condition and you wanted to show off, you could get up to 25 miles an hour. And no matter how sad the automobile situation was at that time, its future was insured, because all the automobile owners bragged about their own car and what a long trip they've made in it and how fast they've gone and how lightly they've climbed up over the hills. And anybody that's been as far as Cape Cod, well, he was really something. And there weren't any legal, there was, well, what's he saying? In the beginning, there was really nothing to disturb your driving legally. As soon as you bought a car, you could take off. It was only later that when there were more cars coming around, when they noticed that even workmen could buy a car for under $1,000, that they started to worry about driver's licenses. My brother John got his driver's license in Concord, Mass., and that one driving test was still in effect when he drove his last at 93. And then when they started to register automobiles, it was always done every year at the beginning of the year. But many a car owner who didn't want to drive during the winter put it up on blocks for 3 months and didn't have to register it till April. And so they made a little bit of money on that 3 months. Now it does seem that the automobile has conquered its lasting place in our lives. First, it was the end to the horse travel. Then it made the streetcar unnecessary, and it almost ended train travel. Now they say there's too many of them, they cost too much, their insurance is too high, and they're one of the leading killers in the nation. Very good. And let me just finish off with one thing. This is something that I had written about a lady in Maynard, and I'll let it go with that. I did this about 4 years ago. I call this In Memory of a Mentor, and it's about a woman that had a great effect on my life back in the 30s. I'm just going to skip around through this thing. I grew up in a section of Maynard that was referred to as Maynard Hill. The founder of the town and the woolen company that was its bread and butter had built his mansions on the side of the hill overlooking his factory, and the other sides of the hill had been developed into streets which in an oddly British fashion were alphabetically named Bancroft, Chandler, Dartmouth, Elmwood, Fairfield. I don't know what happened to A, but it's not there. The Finns, finally being able to buy homes, settled onto this hill in large numbers. And in the 20s, our side of the hill was 99% populated by Finns, and the mixture contained families from all the existing Finnish churches and societies. Of course, all the kids spoke only Finnish until they went to school. What a job for the first grade teacher. A fight under the corner streetlight probably contained as memorable a line as, "Our caterpillars are bigger than your caterpillars." By the 30s, ownership was very much the same, but the kids had now in large part grown to high school age. And when I was born in 27, I was the only baby in the Finnish colony on Maynard's Hill for a while. But happily, I was befriended by an arthritic lady whom I considered ancient then, but now realized was only in her early 60s. She was unmarried, living in the attic of the John and Emma Aho home on the corner of Elmwood and Chandler. Her name was Emilia Gren, and she called herself the children's friend. She was a socialist, as was my family, and she taught me to read Finnish from the ABCs for socialist children. She was born in Hämeenlinna in 1872, came to the United States in the early years of this century. Being young and healthy, she worked as a weaver, lived in one of the local boarding houses. Once, when all her money was stolen from her room, a collection by the other boarders more than refunded her loss, so obviously she was well-liked. But soon, however, arthritis struck, and she had to give up her job. She worked at first as a maid for various Finnish families. Later, unable to continue with hard work, she was still able to crochet and do needlepoint, and this is how she supported herself. But as the disease progressed, even this form of work was denied her. She finally subsisted on the charity of her fellow socialists, who presented her with money every Christmas, name day, and birthday. Her illness didn't prevent her from working with her mind, and she wrote a humorous fist paper, a little newspaper that she edited and read at program meetings every other week. And she didn't forget the children, and soon saw to it that I learned to recite Finnish poetry. I cannot imagine how she got on with her arthritis. The flat was heated with a pile of stove. There was hot water, but just a toilet. The public sauna was on the next street. My mother carried up the coal and the kindling and then carried down the ashes. Her friends decided at this point that government help was needed, and so soon the rent of $7 per month plus $1 for electricity came from the town's welfare department. I remember that whenever my mother cooked vegetables, the water was always saved for Amelia, who drank it as a treatment for her condition. But her proximity enforced my Finnish lessons, and soon I was writing and reading satisfactorily. She died in her sleep when I was 9. According to her wishes, she was buried from the hall. Her will was read at the affair, in which she invited everyone who had ever given her anything to come and to retrieve it in her memory. And many did. She rests in Glenwood Cemetery in a plot given her by the Hiltonen family. I salute the memory of Amelia Grant, my first mentor and truly a children's friend.
Ready?
All set.
All set.
Any questions? Pictures, if anybody wants to look at them before we put them away. They're not all having to do with...